British Public Radio. Nature.
This week, the dramatic landscape of the asteroid Vesta.
It's got a huge cavity on the South Pole. In fact, you wouldn't really call it a crater. It's more like it's missing most of its southern hemisphere.
The company under fire for offering stem cell therapies without proper trials.
Cell techs build themselves as a stem cell banking company, but they also organize treatments for many people, including the governor of Texas.
Plus, how to evolve a pheromone that the opposite sex will just love, if you're a wasp. I'm Kerry Smith.
And I'm Thea Cunningham. The asteroid Vesta is one of the most interesting rocks in our solar system. Orbiting between Mars and Jupiter, it's made of black volcanic material, and it's so large it could almost be a moon. Recently, Vesta was paid a visit by NASA's Dawn spacecraft, which took photos of an unusual feature on its southern hemisphere, a crater so big it makes the whole thing look dented. Eric Ospaug, a researcher at Arizona State University, thinks he knows what hit Vesta. His new simulations show how collisions with two other large asteroids, each dozens of kilometres across, could have caused the dent. But what most interests Ospaug is the material that these collisions threw up. Jeff Brumfield called Ospaug to learn what makes Vesta so strange.
It looks like a mini terrestrial planet whose surface has been dominated by volcanic outflows. And we can't, for the life of us, figure out why it's the only one.
And I guess what's really changed recently in terms of our understanding of Vesta is that we've been able to take a closer look at it thanks to some flyby missions, right, by NASA. What was in there that was surprising?
Vesta surprised everybody. I don't know anybody who sort of thinks they hit the mark in their prediction. It's got a huge cavity on the South Pole. In fact, you wouldn't really call it a crater. It's more like it's missing most of its southern hemisphere, and you can attribute it to two major impact structures. So it's kind of this dented rugby ball shape. And then around the equator, it's got huge troughs. And if you plot the center of these troughs that girdle the whole asteroid, those centers match up with the centers of these enormous impact basins on the southern hemisphere.
Ed, so this is really at the heart of this latest paper that you've got, which is basically you've done some computer modeling to try and figure out why Vesta looks the way it does.
You know, about 15 years ago, the Hubble Space Telescope had seen that it was a dented asteroid. So we could try to reproduce this crater, and we did what we could do in 2D modeling. When Dawn was on its way to Vesta, we were motivated to model this in a lot more detail, and the tools were much better. So we took a 3D hydrocode, they call it, basically a tool for simulating impacts and collisions, and we figured, you know, what size of impact would have created this crater. What was the interesting twist, I mean, literally, is that Vesta is spinning with a period of only about 5 hours. So it's spinning about, you know, almost five times faster than the Earth is. If you think of a major impact event occurring on a body of this size that's really spinning fast, it's like a carnival ride, and you throw stuff up, and then it comes down in a really weird place that you don't expect.
And so what did you find, I guess? What was the big result here?
The fact that we had two craters to play with made it possible to try to recreate the actual shape of Vesta seen by the Dawn mission. We started with a sphere and then beat up the sphere with the first impact, and then we impacted it a second time. And again, we're picking the locations and the size of the simulated impactors based on the crater basins that Dawn saw on Vesta. And so the first impact followed by the second impact on the spinning object, you end up laying down ejecta, and it looks just like Vesta. So the first thing we said was, hey, we have a pretty good explanation for why Vesta is shaped the way it is. Now, that's not a really big deal, because of course things get battered and they get reshaped. But the second inference that you could make from this modeling was, you know, how deep did you dig when you made these basins? And since the two craters form on the same hemisphere, you dig about 50 kilometers deep with the first one, and then the second one digs about 50 kilometers further. So you're excavating stuff from the middle of the asteroid and scattering it all over the surface. And that led to the major scientific conclusion of the paper, which is what we see on the surface of Vesta is mostly basaltic. If, as we think, Vesta is a differentiated planet like a mini Mars or a mini Earth, then when you dig deep inside it, you should be pulling out these mantle materials. And instead, what we see on the surface of Vesta is mostly crustal rock. And so there's something missing from our understanding of Vesta.
So if Vesta is missing this sort of mantle, proto-mantle type material, it's only basaltic, I mean, what does this tell us about our own Earth and Mars and how the planets formed? Does it change anything in the way we think about how the planets came together?
It certainly does, because some of the things we can date about the Earth, you can date when the core of the Earth formed. You can pick up a rock and you can find out when these rock-loving elements separated from iron-loving elements long ago. And you can actually use this as a chronometer, and you'll find out that the core of the Earth formed something like, 5 million years after the Earth's formation. So the core formed pretty quickly. The thing is, you don't know if you're dating the Earth's core formation or the core formation of the precursors to the Earth. And so this can go back in time until the whole solar system was populated with Vesta-sized bodies. And the question comes down to, do Vesta-sized bodies differentiate into cores, mantles, and crusts like terrestrial planets do? Or in their smaller physical state, their gravity is only 1/30th as great, does the process of rock formation and rock evolution occur differently? Answers don't pop out at us right away, but all we do know is that the scenario for early planet formation is much more nuanced than I think we thought before the Dawn mission.
Eric Ospaug at Arizona State University.
Coming up in the research highlights, infectious bats and the health perks of fish oils. But first, the company jumping the gun and offering unapproved stem cell therapies to desperate patients.
Stem cells promise an elixir, a way to replace faulty cells to treat all manner of disease. Over the past decade, companies offering stem cell therapies have cropped up worldwide. The problem is, some of these therapies have not been approved by governments, but that doesn't stop some patients from knocking on the company's doors. One such company, Celltex, based in Houston, Texas, was set up to offer therapies for conditions from arthritis to Parkinson's disease. Last September, the US Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, stopped it from trading because it hadn't conducted clinical trials to prove its drugs are safe and effective. In a feature this week, Nature reporter David Cyrinowski reveals how this bad practice has launched a showdown in Texas. David began by telling me more about Celltex.
Celltex opened for business in 2011, and they billed themselves as a stem cell banking company. So they're a place where you can put your stem cells, and they'll extract them for you, they'll expand them and culture them, and then they'll put them in this bank. But they also organize treatments for you. They have a bunch of doctors that they work with. In fact, one of the co-founders of the company is a doctor who has provided these treatments for many people, including the governor of Texas.
Now, there are several companies offering these types of therapies in the States and elsewhere. What made you focus on this particular one?
The thing that drew my attention to this case in the first place was the kind of oddness of it. It's a very secretive company who at first didn't have a website and they didn't have a phone number. They say they were just trying to stay low-key, but I have a feeling that they wanted to stay out of the FDA radar.
Okay, and the FDA carried out an inspection of Celltex last year and found quite a few problems. Can you tell me about those?
The problems basically said, you have not proven that these cells are safe. And some things that were marked for experimental use only were being used in banking the cells. The FDA stopped Celltex from providing the stem cells to patients in September. And this January, Celltex has come out and said that it's going to start a real FDA clinical trial. It also says that it's going to start providing the therapies in Mexico, which are two things that seem to be a bit contradictory. One is that you're going to prove the efficacy, and the other one is that you're going to hide from the people who are demanding proof of efficacy.
Have you spoken to any patients of Celltex? What are their experiences of the company?
If you talk to the patients, it's hard not to be extremely sympathetic for them, because they are watching their health disintegrate in front of their eyes, and basically they think their last hope is stem cells. They're willing to take a chance on it, and they don't really want the FDA or anybody else to tell them that they're not allowed to take this chance. So for the most part, most of the patients that I spoke with are very supportive of Celtex. They recognize that there have been problems with Celtex, but at the same time, they do want to have access to these cells.
And what about the response of other scientists to Celtex? I mean, how does this reflect on the field of stem cell therapy as a whole?
I think a lot of other scientists who are in the mainstream in doing research on stem cells are horrified to see this kind of treatment going on without proof of clinical safety and clinical efficacy. But for the most part, these mesenchymal stem cells do seem to have a pretty good profile in terms of safety. There have been some problems that have popped up, but they seem to be, if used correctly, pretty safe.
You mentioned that one of Celtex's patients was the governor of Texas, Rick Perry. He was the company's first patient, in fact. How do you think this political connection has influenced the way Celtex runs its business?
It's probably not a coincidence that this happened in Texas, which often doesn't really like to listen to what the central government is telling it to do. People are saying, well, we don't want the FDA to tell us what we can do with our own stem cells. And that has become kind of a catchphrase among the patient community.
What do you think are the main motivations for those driving Celtex?
There's a lot of money involved here. David Eller and other investors put in $30 million to licensing the technology to make the cells. So they have an investment in there, and the patients are paying basically at least $25,000, $30,000 each to get the treatment. So if you talk to them, they'll say that they're just out there to help patients and that they want to bring this great treatment to patients who need it, which is probably part of the motivation, but it's also kind of hard to believe because they haven't been as responsive to patients' needs as they could have.
And with that in mind, what do you think the future holds for Celtex?
I think in the next year or two, you'll see them figure out some way to get their cells to clinics in Mexico. You know, all of this publicity they're getting now, it might look like bad publicity, but it's drawing a lot of attention to the fact that they're open for business in Mexico. And in the end, they might become one of the more successful in getting patients down there.
Reporter David Cyrinowski there. You can read the feature in full at nature.com/news.
Research highlights now with Charlotte Stoddart. We've all heard about the health benefits of fish oils, specifically the omega-6 fats. Now researchers think they found a possible cellular mechanism for this benefit, at least in worms. They found that when nematode worms eat omega-6 oils, they live longer. And it's because their cells have activated a process called autophagy. This process was the star of our podcast from January 31st. It's a cellular recycling method, and it helps cells to survive starvation conditions by recycling excess cell components. The new study was in the journal Genes and Development. In the Hollywood movie Contagion, a new virus originates in bats and goes on to cause a massive disease outbreak. And there could be some truth to the bat origin of deadly viruses. A study suggests that bats are riddled with viruses that can be transmitted from one species to another. Researchers reviewed the literature looking for reports of such viruses. They found that bats carry an average of just under 2 viruses per species, more than rodents. This could be because different bat species tend to live close together, which could allow for more frequent transfer. So although you might see more rats than bats, it's the latter that are more likely to spread their germs around. Find the paper in the Proceedings of the Royal Society.
When it comes to flirting, we all have our own style, and it's no different for wasps. Instead of chat-up lines, wasps use complex chemical perfumes called pheromones. In wasps of the genus Nasonia, it's the male that produces the pheromone and the female that picks it up. Most Nasonia wasps use the same basic blend, but one species, Nasonia vitripennis, has an extra chemical in its pheromone potion which sets it apart. But how did this novel pheromone system evolve? And what came first, the male pheromone or the female's ability to detect it? Scientists at the Zoological Research Museum in Bonn in Germany think they have the answer. Noah Baker asked Oliver Niehus for a flirting lesson.
If you want to attract mates, you don't want to waste time attracting mates of the wrong species. Or when you are the receiver, you don't want to get attracted by mates with which you cannot mate, or even if you mate, you may not have offspring. So there's a huge advantage of tracking only conspecifics.
The wasps in the genus Nasonia, they all use pheromones to attract their mates, but one species' pheromones were not quite like the others, is that correct?
That's correct, yes. We wanted to find out what the importance of this new pheromone component was, and so we provided females of Nasonia vitripennis, as well as females of the sister lineage, Nasonia gerauti, with the individual pheromone compounds chemically isolated from each other. And it turns out that the additional pheromone component makes only sense for the females of Nasonia vitripennis, but females of Nasonia gerauti don't apparently perceive it.
That suggests that the new pheromone can evolve without the receiver's awareness. How does that work in Nasonia vitripennis?
Well, we were also wondering about this. We used an approach, it's called quantitative trait locus mapping, and you can search what regions correlate in the genotype with the presence of this additional pheromone component. We were able to narrow down the location in the genome to rather small regions, about 43,000 base pairs. This region harbored only a handful of genes, and we immediately thought that one of these genes could actually mediate the transversion of one pheromone component into the other.
So am I right in thinking that the new pheromone component is very similar to the old pheromone components?
Yes, actually it is. It has exactly the same constituents. It's simply that the orientation of an alcohol group within the molecule is different in one of these components from the other. Think about a tree with, you know, the same number of branches, and instead of having the branch on the left-hand side, you have it on the right-hand side. Many new pheromone components show striking similarity, actually, chemically to pre-existing pheromone components. And so there had been the idea that new pheromone components evolve by modification of existing signaling molecules. And our study provide actually support for this idea.
So there's a very simple set of genes which allows the sender, the male wasp, to modify one of its existing pheromones and make a new pheromone. And then, over time, the females can develop a mechanism to start perceiving it.
That's exactly what we think is going on, yes. Previous studies actually stated that you need to have a predisposition for a new pheromone blend. Our study actually suggests that you can have a change in the pheromone first, and that the receiver subsequently adapts to this new pheromone to exploit actually its information. These two modes of evolution, or how pheromones can evolve, are not mutually exclusive. We don't think that the mechanism we found is always happening. It might be that in some cases the pheromones evolve as in the model that we suggest, and that in other cases there is indeed a predisposition by the receiver for a new pheromone blend even before it evolved.
So when it comes to sex in wasps, sometimes it's the sender, sometimes it's the receiver. It's definitely mixed signals.
Yes, that's right.
Oliver Nihu's talking to Noah Baker. Finally this week, some news as always. Richard Van Norden is here, as always. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Kerry.
Now, first of all, we're deep into February, deep into flu season, and your first story is about flu and Google.
Yeah, so flu's really hit quite hard this year, but it's also claimed a rather unacknowledged victim, and that is one of the cutting-edge techniques being used to monitor flu, Google searches. In fact, I'm talking about Google Flu Trends. Basically, that estimates the prevalence of flu based on flu-related internet searches. And over the past few years, people have said this is a really good way of monitoring the flu outbreak. But this year, Google kind of got it wrong.
Can you tell us a bit more about the principle behind this? Literally, it's just as simple as who's searching for flu and where do they live?
So obviously there's traditional flu monitoring, and in traditional flu monitoring, you get doctors to report cases of patients with flu-like illness, and then you test a subset of those people to see how many of them actually have flu. So, okay, 60% of them actually have flu, and then you scale that up to the whole world, and you do it per country. And you also have this social media style reporting network, such as Google Flu Trends. It's launched in 2008. And it basically relies on data mining records of flu-related search terms entered in the Google search engine, combined with computer modeling. And its estimates have almost exactly matched surveillance data over time. And the clever thing, of course, it delivers them several days faster than the surveillance data based on physicians' reports can. It's been rolled out to 29 countries worldwide.
So what went wrong this year?
Well, this year, the Google estimate for the Christmas national peak of flu was almost double what the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, in the US had. And some of its data by state show even larger discrepancies. And Google wouldn't talk to us about this year's difficulties, but some researchers said the problem might have been widespread media coverage of the US flu season, including when New York declared a public health emergency, and that because of all these press reports, maybe there were many flu-related searches from people who weren't ill.
So media reports provoking some kind of flu hypochondria.
Yeah. Now, you know, few doubt that Google is going to bounce back here. They're going to adjust their algorithms. We're still in the early days of this kind of social media sort of concept for tracking epidemics. But it's kind of a reminder that these systems are only ever going to complement but not substitute for traditional surveillance networks. You can't rely just on what people are searching for in Google or on Twitter.
So a quick and dirty first estimate.
Exactly.
All right. Good stuff. On to story number two then, where synthetic biology makes a breakthrough.
This project, the idea that genetically engineering microbes in order to produce a useful drug, this project has been one of the sort of poster boys for that whole concept. Way back in 2006, Jay Kiesling at the University of California in Berkeley showed you could genetically engineer yeast to produce artemisinic acid, which is not some boring chemical. It's actually a precursor to one of the best malaria treatments available. Now, this malaria treatment based on artemisinin, well, the problem is that at the moment you can only get it by planting a plant and then you have to extract, and it takes over a year to get to your final drug from your plant. And as a result, supply and demand of this drug has been bouncing around all over the place as thousands of small-scale farmers rush to plant, and then there's an oversupply, and then they all stop planting, and there's an undersupply. And so finally, last month, the pharmaceutical company Sanofi revealed that they'd actually produced 39 tons of artemisinic acid, the first sort of industrial-scale deployment of synthetic biology for drug production.
39 tons does sound like an awful lot. Do we have any idea of how many doses that is?
Well, the stock could be converted to about 40 million treatments, says Kiesling. And here you get to some of the kind of messy ferment of the real-world markets, because what this drug that's produced synthetically is replacing is all these farmers who are planting plants. And they, in turn, are worried that the drug is going to be sold very cheaply and it will undercut their livelihoods. They're worried that those 40 million treatments could be maybe as much as a third of the total demand for this malaria-based drug.
So there are some off-target effects, we could call them, on the financial and the market situation for this. In terms of how it will help to treat malaria, 40 million doses, did you say?
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot. I mean, will it make a dent?
Well, what it should do is make malaria treatments much cheaper, because it should be possible to produce the malaria drug much more cheaply and much more reliably than is currently the case. You could just fire up the fermenters if you suddenly realise that you need more malaria drugs within 3 months. You have your synthetically produced drug. I suppose what you ultimately have to consider is it's not just about how cheap can you make your drugs, but actually how easy is it to distribute them and to get them to the people who need them, often in remote places with no distribution networks. And I think Kiesling has discovered in the sort of 6 or 7 years that it's taken to go from paper in Nature to commercial production of drug, that this is just as important a part of the story as cutting down the costs and getting the microbes and the big fermenters. But nonetheless, it's a big landmark for synthetic biology.
All right. Richard van Noorden, thank you for firing up the news fermenters for us. And more on both of those stories at nature.com/news.
Next week, there's a fight brewing over fisheries. I'm Thea Cunningham.
And I'm Kerry Smith.